Follow Mooney Goes Wild on Twitter
at NatureRTE.
We're talking about bats and how they manage to get around in their surroundings. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to be any creature on Earth? And if you could be any creature on Earth, what would you be? Ever wondered what it would be like to live in their world and see their surroundings as they do? Guys, put your headphones on if you will, because you're going to need them now. Well, now you can. Dr. Jolyon Trushianko is a postdoctoral research associate at the Centre for Ecology and Conservation at the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom. And he and his team have developed an application that digitally processes types of photos and then converts them into images that show the way various animals might view their surroundings. Jolyon joins us now from the BBC Cornwall Studios to tell us more about his work. So, Jolyon, tell me a little bit about your work.
So I work on sensory ecology. That's why animals look the way they do, whether that's trying to stand out, to attract a mate with bright, powerful colours and displays, or trying to blend into the background completely by using camouflage to evade being spotted by predators. And so because I need to know why animals look like this, how they evolved, we also need to see through the eyes of the predator that might be looking for the camouflaged animal, or through the eyes of that potential mate that is viewing that sexual display.
What we see in the world looking at things may not necessarily be what the predator sees. You have pictures on the site there I'm looking at of a flower, and it's seen in completely different colours, it seems to me, by a ladybird, by a human and by a ferret, because each of them are looking at the flower through different wavelengths, really.
Yes, absolutely. Our normal human vision, that's people with normal red, green, blue vision, we are sensitive to just those three primary colours, and our brain combines those three colours to make the millions of different colours that we can see. But other animals have more or fewer primary colours. So the ferret that you mentioned, for example, that's a typical mammal, and most other mammals, other than the monkeys in Africa and humans, they only see the world in two colours, that's blue and yellow, and so they make up lots of colours. They still see the world in quite a lot of colour, but not as much as we can. But then it starts to get really confusing when you imagine birds, for example, that have four primary colours that their eyes are sensitive to. So they sense the red, green and blue that we can see, but they can even see deeper into ultraviolet than we can, with a whole extra fourth colour receptor channel. So it's almost impossible for us to imagine what the world might look like to a bird.
And then insects are in that ultraviolet range as well, because sometimes we see pictures of flowers as through the eye of an insect, and the lines going into the flower where the nectar is like the runway at Dublin Airport, all lit up, whereas we looking at the flowers with our own eyes don't see this at all.
Yeah, absolutely. There are all these hidden signals in ultraviolet that flowers use that we can't see. They, as you say, they guide the insect into the middle of the flower. Because lots of insects, they are sensitive to ultraviolet, but their vision is very, very low resolution compared to ours. It's like looking through a very pixelated scene. And so the flowers need to use big, bold sprays of colour to attract them to the general region with lots of flowers. But then they need to use smaller scale ultraviolet signals to lure them into the middle of the flower where there's all the pollen and nectar.
So how can you work out then how an insect can see or how a bird can see? I mean, you mentioned colours like red and green and yellow and blue. I mean, we can see red and green and yellow and blue. So what more? What's this extra dimension the birds have?
Well, of course, I mentioned red, green, yellow and blue, but that's a continuous spectrum. So the spectrum of wavelengths goes from, you know, from radio waves to X-rays and gamma rays. And the visible spectrum that we can see is just a very small section in the middle. And even though I say that birds can see the red, green and blue, they actually are sensitive to slightly different ranges of red, greens and blues and ultraviolets. So, for example, the green and red that we can see is very overlapping. Our red-green vision isn't actually very good. Whereas birds have tiny little oil droplets in their eyes that tune the frequencies of light so that their colour vision is much more precise than ours. So the reds and greens that they can see will be far more detailed than the ones we can see.
Can you look at an animal's eyes and look at the cones at the back of those eyes? Could you do this physically and infer what wavelengths that animal will respond to based solely on those cones? Or do you have to carry out experiments where you put coloured flowers down and things and see what the animals do?
There's a variety of ways of trying to work out exactly what colours the animals are sensitive to. But you're right, looking at the retina, taking out the cone cells from the retina, and then using, for example, microspectrophotometry, where you shine light through there, through the cells, and see what lights, wavelengths of light are absorbed, and therefore what it's sensitive to. But that doesn't give you the whole picture, because then you've got the lens and the other material in the eye that actually filters out some of the light. And then, as you say, you also try and use behavioral experiments. Another technique is to use electroretinogram, where you pulse light at a cone cell that you have in a petri dish, for example, with an electrode on the back, and you see as you change the frequency of light whether the cell starts or stops responding to the pulses of light. So it can get quite complicated, and that's very difficult work to do. Behavioral experiments, of course, are the best way of ultimately working out what an animal responds to.
Watching the 9 o'clock news, we're sitting in front of the 9 o'clock news. Now, we imagine we're seeing a continuous world image in front of us. I'm told that a bumblebee doing the same thing sees what's really there. That is 50 frames, or rather 25 half frames interleaved every second. It is able to discriminate time on a totally different axis to us. Now, when you do your camouflage experiments and your judgments of what the animals see, do you factor in time? Their time rate and their kind of relativity applies. They're flying at a much different rate to us. Is that something you have to factor in, or can you?
Oh, at the moment, we're only working with still images primarily, just because the processing involved and the taking the photos is very difficult to do. So, for example, to simulate what a bee might see, we would need to take images in the visible and ultraviolet simultaneously. And at the moment, that's very difficult to do with hyperspectral cameras at high frame rates. So currently, there's pretty much no technology that can work as well as bee vision at working out the wavelengths that bees can see. And working with stills, of course, we don't need to worry about this too much. But of course, there are going to be huge differences in the resolution temporally and spatially that all different visual systems can see.
Joy Lydon, it's Emma Teeling here from UCD. Work that goes on in my lab when we try to understand more what animals can or can't see is done at the genomic level, where we just go and we look at their opsin genes and see what colours of wavelength of light that the species would be tuned to be able to see. Now, I have done a lot of work on bats, but I would love to use some of your technology to advance what we now know, because still I'm very confused about why UV vision is so very important for some species of bats and not for some others. And it might be a nice way to do what you do, using some of the information that we have, and to work out what can bats actually see.
Yeah, that would be really fascinating. And why would UV vision be useful for nocturnal bats as well? Or is it just the diurnal ones? I'm not sure.
Well, it's for all. So the bats we looked at, the majority of bats are all nocturnal. And the ones that we look at, they're very active at dawn and dusk. And this is where there's an awful lot of UV light. And so the question is, UV vision must be very important because it's been maintained over time for 65 million years in things that are nocturnal but also have echolocation. But then there are two or three different lineages. Fruit bats that roost in caves where UV vision isn't important at all. The genes aren't there. They don't work. Or for some of these bats, it uses really advanced type of echolocation. So I'd love to always, it's been a conundrum for myself and all my colleagues working on this, as to what can they really see. But this might be an idea for us to get a better image, given our trichromatic vision, of what does their UV dichromatic vision look like.
So you mentioned that there's more UV light at dusk and dawn. Of course, that's right, but that's only proportionately compared to the red, green and blue. So
yes. The
absolute light levels are very low, and UV is actually very difficult to sense at low levels because the noise, the photon noise that you get. So their UV vision will probably not be very good, even with their sensitivity to it. So it'd be fascinating. It'd probably be a very noisy, interesting image that they'd get. So it must be very important for them to see UV if they've really kept that evolutionarily.
Yeah, and behaviorally, they've shown that the bats that are feeding on flowers, that it's the UV they're seeing from the flowers. So maybe it's something else. You know, also, maybe it's behavioral interaction between the bats themselves. Not sure.
I wanted to ask you about images. You were showing, again, on what we were looking at was a nightjar type bird with all this camouflage pattern and sitting still in a background that looked like itself dead leaves and whatever. And the giveaway sign was the outline image of this bird. If you couldn't see the outline, it was camouflaged against its background. But depending on what's looking at it, obviously we looking at a nightjar are not their deadly enemies compared to a predator that's going to eat it. So are they seen in different ways by different things? Yeah, I'm just thinking about the red-green colour blindness that some people have, and they can't see a red ball in the green grass and other people can. Is it the same thing that here's a thing sitting there, it can be seen perfectly well by things that aren't going to be a danger to it, but it's not being seen at all by its predator?
There will be big differences, and this is one of the reasons we needed to develop the software so that we can, you know, see through the eyes of a predator and see what the nightjar looks like, and what aspects of its camouflage. Is it the colour or the pattern, for example, that stands out to different predators? Now, you mentioned that we humans aren't a predator, but actually, where we worked, the humans would happily eat the nightjar's eggs, and there are also vervet monkeys there, and they have almost identical vision to humans, the same kind of red, green, and blue. But then you have birds with the UV sensitivity and more detailed colour vision, and they will certainly see the nightjars in a different way. Initially, our results seem to suggest, though, that colour isn't actually that important. It's more the pattern. The nightjars are so good at generally matching the colour to all predators that it's the pattern that mostly seems to give them away.
Tommy Hayden, in his book on Irish mammals, had a very interesting phrase that has always stuck in my mind. It says, the specialists go to the wall, the generalists inherit the earth. Now, here we have your nightjar. He has refined a very, very detailed specialist camouflage in a fast-changing world. Is there a tension here between getting too good at camouflaging yourself and coping with the changes that inevitably take place? Is there a tension? Is there a dualism going on there?
Yeah, an absolutely fascinating question. Of course, there will be a big tension. If you've evolved for millions of years to look exactly like a specific kind of dead leaf, and then because of ecological changes or environmental changes, that leaf is no longer in your habitat anymore, then you're going to be in big trouble. And the nightjars, they're actually surprisingly good generalists, some of them. And this was one of the things we tried to look at, is what makes a good generalist versus specialist camouflage type. Because some nightjars are quite good at nesting on different types of ground, so bare earth or in leaf litter or amongst grass, whereas others pretty much only nest in leaf litter. So we were trying to work out what aspects of camouflage make you better at being a generalist or a specialist. And you might well expect that the specialists are more vulnerable over long periods of time if they can't keep up with their environment. But there's probably going to be leaf litter around for a long time, so as long as you can match that quite well, then I think they're fairly safe.
Thank you very much indeed, Julian.
Thank you for having me.
Follow us on Facebook, RTE Nature.
Mooney Goes Wild on RTE Radio 1.